Hey, it's Ron Van Dam. Remember, you clicked on me. Well, not on me specifically. You clicked on the show, and here it is. We do interviews on this program toward the end of every program. And we have a lot of them. So we decided to do an interview special. That's what this is. It's above and beyond our regular shows. So this is extra. You don't have to pay for this. It's free. We're going to hear from doctors and experts in all different kinds of fields and things. And we're going to do that right now. You ready? Sit back. Here we go.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Mm-hmm. Hold on tight. Right. Things can get a bit weird.
They will.
If you like that sort of thing. Whatever.
Well, we're going to We're going to start off with Dan Klein, who's with the Pan Foundation. This isn't a foundation that makes pans. This is a foundation where I don't think you knew this. If you're on Medicare or you need some medical assistance financially, you can't afford things. They have a foundation that actually pulls money together to actually help you out and pay some of your medical costs. Yeah, not so bad at all. Dan Klein joins us. He's the president and CEO of the PAN, which involves a Medicare plan to help prevent avoidable costs. Most people think Medicare is free. That's not the case, is it?
No, not at all. Medicare can cost quite a bit, both for the premiums, but importantly for the out-of-pocket costs. So the PAN Foundation, which is short for Patient Access Network Foundation, helps people cover their deductibles, their co-pays, helps them pay for the costs in the coverage gap or donut hole, as it's sometimes called. Right. And a lot of people on Medicare who are seriously ill, who have cancer or Parkinson's or MS or another serious illness, often need help paying for the out-of-pocket costs of their prescription medications. And particularly at the beginning of the year, that can be a big deal for people on Medicare because the Medicare benefit resets at the beginning of each calendar year.
Okay. So how would you qualify for a financial aid in that sense?
Well, the easiest way to find out whether you qualify is simply to call the PAN Foundation at 866-316-7263 or visit our website at panfoundation.org. Generally speaking, the eligibility criteria are that you have a serious illness that we cover. We cover about 70 different illnesses, that you're taking one of the medications that's on the formularies for each of these diseases that we cover, that you live in the United States, and that you have an income that's below 500% of federal poverty level. Most of the people we provide assistance to are people who are between 200 and 400% of federal poverty level. So that's between around $30,000 a year up to about $60,000 or $70,000 a year. And a lot of people at that income level really struggle, even though they have insurance, to pay for their deductibles and copays. So we're trying to help those people, and we provide grants to well over 100,000 people a year.
Are these financial aids expected to be paid back, or is this through the foundation?
No, it's a grant, so it's not paid back. It's designed to cover someone's deductibles and copays for a full year of treatment. Yeah. It's really important for people who have a serious illness to stay on their medication and to take it as their physician has prescribed. So we provide a grant that's intended to help them do that.
So no more would someone on Medicare have to say, I can't afford the proper care that I've been prescribed because I just don't have the money, so I can't do it. That won't be the case anymore.
Exactly. That's exactly right. A lot of people on Medicare either can't start taking a medication, or they skip taking their medication, or they cut their pills in half. because they can't afford the out-of-pocket cost.
Yeah, and Dan, there was a time not long ago where that was indeed the case.
It is still the case for many people. So it's important for people who are on Medicare or on another insurance to look for help if they need it. And help is available. A lot of people don't realize that PAN and other charities are available to help with these costs.
Yeah.
And it's easy to do. So, again, you can call PAN at 866-316-7263 or visit our website at panfoundation.org.
You know, I do thousands of interviews a year. I very rarely hear a phone number. And I tell you why I think that's important is because seniors aren't always app friendly. They can't navigate the internet, open up internet accounts to find things out. I mean, you can, but some of them just really can't because they just didn't do it all their lives. And they feel very stymied.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. So
that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
About half of the people who come to us come through our phone, and the other half do come through our website.
Yeah.
But again, we're providing grants to well over 100,000 people a year, so it's important that they know the phone number and can reach us.
Okay, let's do the phone number one more time slowly, and again, the website for those that have the ability.
Okay, it's 866-316-7263, and our website is PAN, P-A-N, foundation.org, all one word, panfoundation.org, and people can visit the website or call us, and we can tell them whether we can help them with their out-of-pocket costs.
There you go. No more need be said. It's there for you. Thank you so much, Dan. Important information. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good morning.
Hello, everybody. Sonia Kushuk joins us. She's a cancer survivor and founder of Sonia Kushuk Beauty. And Rebecca Nellis, who's an MPP, I don't know what that is, Executive Director of Cancer and Careers. What is MPP?
Master of Public Policy.
Oh, nice. I like that. Okay.
See, you learn something new every day.
I try to. I try my hardest. We're talking about the workplace and cancer survivors, people who are diagnosed in various levels and types, and how they keep on going. Why is conversation about the workplace so important?
Well, like for all of us, work tends to play a role in our lives or the lives of our loved ones. Mm-hmm. And so when someone is diagnosed with cancer, that work piece doesn't necessarily go away. It just becomes more complicated, really. And so helping someone figure out what their best options are and why work matters to them and then how they can do that in light of their diagnosis is critical.
I guess the major question that I would have would be how do you tell your coworkers of your diagnosis? Do you? What do you say? How involved do you get, et cetera?
Well, so you got to what was going to be my first part of my answer to that question in your second part of the question, which was, do you? So that's a really big question.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are diagnosed find themselves giving a lot of thought to whether or not they're going to share this information at work, be it coworkers or their supervisor or HR. And so for every person, that's going to be a different equation because everybody's workplace and their role within that workplace looks a little bit different. And so what's important to us at Cancer and Careers is that a person has the tools to think that through and figure out what benefits would come from disclosing and also what concerns they have about it so they can be strategic in thinking it through.
Yeah, most people probably don't want to be treated any differently. Or will they be treated differently accordingly in a manner that is uncomfortable for them? There's so many levels to that question, I guess.
That's exactly right. And most people in the best light don't want to be treated differently, but also there's concern about losing their job, not just being treated differently. So it can run a whole spectrum. And then for other people, disclosing at work, if they've made that choice, is really can be really beneficial and can create new avenues of support. I know Sonia was decided to be public about her experience.
Right.
And so she can tell you a little bit more about why that mattered to her, and what's so important to us is that people feel empowered to make the best choice for themselves.
So, Sonia, what was your situation?
You know, I think that for me, I you know, at the time I had a beauty brand that was at Target, and I felt that I had the opportunity to educate women on beauty. And after my diagnosis with cancer, that I felt I could take that and make it positive for myself and help educate women on breast cancer and what it, you know, and what I knew and what my journey was and how I dealt with it. But it is quite personal because, you know, everybody deals with it differently. I've spoken to many women that do not want to discuss it, don't want to talk about it, hold it in a very private way. But I think one of the really interesting things that I've learned through cancer and careers as well is that when receiving a cancer diagnosis, the first question is, will I die? And the second question is, can I work? Because everybody needs, you know, the financial. So I think that plays, that's the importance of, you know, what cancer and careers does in the workplace, that it is the number two question asked, you know, on a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah. But yet publicly, this is the first time I've heard of, I mean, obviously that's a consideration, but I publicly never discussed that or thought that through, which I guess is quite interesting. And I guess in the workplace you develop friendships and relationships. And it's almost like if you don't, then you're hiding something where you've already set up a trustful relationship. Very, very confusing.
It is. It can be a real challenge because some people are very open at work. And so to suddenly not share this enormous thing that's happening to them would be totally foreign, whereas other people are a little more reserved or private or wouldn't think to share something far less significant than this, so why would they share this? And so I think it tends to be a spectrum, and it's not an all or nothing equation.
I understand all of that. Yeah, very, very interesting. A survey was taken recently. What were the results of that, and what was it?
Yes. So every year, Cancer and Careers partners with the Harris Poll to make sure that we're hearing from cancer survivors all over the country, and not just cancer survivors who have reached out to us, so we can really get a good sense of what the experience is like year after year. And so the survey covers a wide range of topics, really getting a sense of what it's like to be a survivor and someone who needed to deal with work. And each year I'm always interested in the things that stay the same as much as the things that are different. So, you know, one of my favorite stats year over year is around the fact that survivors often at very high percentages think that work aids in their treatment and recovery. So this year, 69% of them said that. And to me, I can't 100% know what they mean by AIDS, but the idea that work has a positive impact on their well-being, I think, is incredibly important, not just for other survivors to know, but for employers to know, for HR professionals to know that work has this positive benefit. So the employer keeps a great employee, and the employee gets something that's valuable to their overall well-being. So that's a pretty important thing to know as well.
Sonia, let me ask you, obviously there's the physical component of the diagnosis, but how, in percentage wise, how important is the psychology of it? In other words, if you set your mind in the proper mode, keep it busy, set a psychological stance for yourself, how much does that affect your actual physical recovery?
I mean, you know, I can only say from what my my you know, what I dealt with, but I would say that, you know, 100%. I mean, I think that when you don't sit and focus on the negative all day long or looking at it through a negative, I mean, there's, you know, going to work, you know, when I speak to both for myself or to other individuals, it is the healthiest thing you can do is just have your mind go somewhere else. because you hear that word cancer continually.
Yes.
You wonder what the journey is going to be. You don't know. And so when you can focus on something else and add some sense of normalcy to your life, that where it's not just focused about you and what you're dealing with, but like a, something else that's completely random or not, I think is super empowering and really healthy. Because when, you know, even when any of us have a cold, and if you think about how miserable you feel versus when you do something else, we all know the impact that has.
Right. So it can actually, I mean, I always believe that the mind can actually, I wouldn't say heal the body, but certainly aid in it. I guess in some cases, probably can.
I totally agree.
Yeah. There's so much more to talk about, but we have time restrictions here. So where can we go for more information?
Cancer and Careers' website, www.cancerandcareers.org, is kind of the hub for all the programs and services we offer and information for employers and coworkers, as well as the person diagnosed and their family and loved ones.
You know, the number one thing, whether it's cancer or depression or anything else, it's support and knowing that other people are going through it and having people around you that are going through the same thing you are. It's like, it's everything, isn't it?
It is. Knowing you're not alone is
yes.
key.
Yes. Thank you so much for your time. You doing well now, Sonia?
Yeah, all well. Thank you so much.
All right. Hey, great speaking to the both of you.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm really not so bad. Ingrid Giskis joins us now. She's a global head of the campaign this is actually very, very interesting here. Tell me about the campaign, actually. It's the World Animal Protection Sea Change. What is that?
So World Animal Protection Sea Change campaign focuses on the issue of lost and abandoned fishing gear or ghost gear. So annually about 800,000 tons of fishing gear get lost or abandoned in our oceans. And that figure is actually from 2009, so it's likely that much, much more fishing gear is ending up our oceans today.
Right.
So World Animal Protection Sea Change campaign focuses on reducing, removing, and recycling fishing gear and tackle the problem across the three R's, as we call them.
Yeah. Is there one country that is usually more dumping junk or losing junk than other countries?
So first of all, lost or abandoned fishing gear ends up in our ocean, mostly unintentionally.
Uh-huh.
So the main cause of fishing gear ending up in our ocean is adverse weather conditions or bad fishing gear practices.
Okay.
There's only a very small percentage that ends up in our oceans because of illegal dumping. Fishing gear and ghost gear is a global problem and requiring a global solution. So our oceans don't have any borders. So, for example, fishing gear that might be lost or abandoned in Indonesia can end up in Australia, and the same goes for the U.S. So there's not one particular country where we would say is the key problem, really. That there's a number of countries that can do better and can do more, including in the U.S., we don't like to really finger point because we feel everyone should be part of the solution.
And as you say, the majority of it is by accident.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. As opposed to countries dumping their garbage into the oceans, that's not by accident.
No, obviously, sometimes fishing gear is dumped intentionally in the ocean, and mostly that's linked to illegal fishing. So, for example, when fishermen don't have a license to fish, they also don't have access to disposal facilities on shore. So what they will do is dump it in the ocean, or also if they're being chased by authorities, they will abandon their gear to evade capture. Often they also fish at night, which also makes it more likely for them to lose gear. So all of these factors can contribute to them intentionally discarding or dumping gear at sea. But again, the majority of gear ending up in our ocean doesn't happen through that way. It's only a very small percentage.
Ingrid, what exactly is the gear? I mean, I know, is it fishing poles, nets, that kind of thing?
Yes, yeah, so anything really. When I say the 800,000 tons figure, I'm referring to nets, tots, traps, hooks, lines, recreational fishing gear, anything really that is used to catch fish.
Okay. Which is different than entire ships going down, where I understand, I mean, I could be wrong, but that can actually be a harbor for sea life to actually exist off of sunken ships. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's a really interesting fact, actually. And it's actually the same for fishing gear. So sometimes fishing gear or vessels or things that end up in the ocean do form artificial reefs for fish. And so, for example, when we look at removing fishing gear, which is something that we do quite frequently as part of the campaign, we always have to assess that removing the gear actually is better than leaving the gear in the ocean. For example, an interesting project in Vanuatu that we did recently was where we're assessing a lost net on a coral reef. So we had to make sure that actually removing the net was more beneficial for our oceans and our ocean's life than leaving the net and potentially damaging sensitive habitats. So it's always a consideration that we have to make before we remove fishing gear.
Okay. So to do that, you probably need the public's help.
Yes, we do, definitely. So there's three things that people can do to help our campaign. First of all, it's really learning more about the issue of ghost gear, because what we really like to see is industry and government take action and become part of the solution. So the more people know about the issue and speak out about the issue, the louder our voice of change will be. And to learn more, you can visit our website, worldanimalprotection.us, to learn a bit more about the campaign. Secondly, what you can do is making sure that you're a responsible consumer and that you buy sustainable seafood. And doing that, you can look out for sustainability labels on seafood, such as the Marine Stewardship Council label, MSC, Friend of the Sea label, or Seafood Watch, where you can learn about which labels take ghost gear and gear loss prevention into account when they certify their fisheries. And thirdly, it's really continuing to support the work of World Animal Protection so that we can continue to fight the fight against ghost gear.
Okay. This seafood thing there, is that printed on cans and on products?
Yes, it is. Yeah, so it's actually very easy. You don't need to be a technical fisheries expert in order to know what seafood you should buy. So all you have to do is really look out for a small label on, for example, cans of tuna that says MSC. And when you see that, you know that you're buying the right kind of seafood and you're not contributing to the problem.
Well, I like that. I'm glad that's good. All right. Yeah, I don't aid companies that don't do well and don't care about things like that. So that's good. I'm going to only support those that do. All right. One more time, that website to visit for more information?
Yes. So this holiday season, please go to our website, worldanimalprotection.us, where you can find more information about the Sea Change campaign and how to be a responsible consumer.
It's always great to talk to people that care, and thank you for doing that. Really, seriously, these days that doesn't happen a lot, unfortunately, so good. I'm glad that's still applicable.
Well, thanks so much. I'm glad that you care as well, so
yes.
It's mutual.
Wonderful. Ingrid, thank you so much today.
Thank you, Ron.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Good morning.
Hi, Dr. Lee Lindquist joins us now. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. She's the chief of geriatrics at Northwestern Medicine and Northwestern Memorial Hospital and Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. She has all kinds of letters after her name, MPH, MBA, you name it. Okay. Let's get down to it. Geriatrics, we're all going to be in that category someday, if not now. So this is of
if we're lucky.
we're assuming. We're assuming that we're going to get there. Every once in a while, I know your organization does various studies. I guess there was one recently done and published in the Journal of American Geriatrics Society. What was the data that came out of that?
Yeah, so here at Northwestern Medicine, we're very interested in helping seniors in their own home because we know aging in place is so important.
Yeah.
And so what I see a lot in my clinics and in the geriatric population that I work with is that so many seniors would benefit from help, you know, whether it's a, you know, a homemaker or somebody helping with the cleaning or the cooking. But then many times they refuse it, which is mind-boggling for some people that are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, because we would definitely accept help like that. So we asked seniors, we did a study where we actually asked seniors, you know, why are you refusing help? And what we heard was that they were very worried that if they stopped, you know, if they were unable to do something, that that meant they'd be one step closer to the nursing home. Or that, you know, I would be a burden on somebody if I had to have somebody help me. And so we figured these things out, but then we said, you know, how can we help you help us get you help? And so that's where we said, listen, you know, what would make you more willing to accept help? And the seniors that we talked to had really good ideas and strategies. For instance, you know, it's not just being independent. Everyone's dependent on somebody, so it's more about a change in interdependence. And one of my favorite things that came out was the idea that if I accept help from somebody, that means that I'm giving them an opportunity to experience joy. Because whenever I've helped people, I feel joy because I know I'm doing something good. And so, so many times people say, you know, you need help, you can't do this. And that's not the way to talk to our seniors. The seniors would rather say, you know what, this helps me or this gives me joy by helping you, so let's make it happen as more of a partnership.
That's a great way of putting it, as a partnership, because we all have pride, or most humans do, and help and aid is it means I can't do it myself anymore all the time or at all. But doing it with somebody in partnership or with somebody, that's a different story. Even, you know, verbally, it sounds better.
Yeah, and it's a mutual benefit. I think that's what came up, is that it's just not to serve that one person.
Yeah.
It's because me helping you makes me feel better.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the strategies we talked about.
Yeah. You know, there's still a lot of people who don't understand that it's not like you're independent or you're in a nursing home. They don't think there's other options. And, you know, people talk about it, but a lot of people's minds, it's like one or the other, but that's not the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what's interesting is having that communication with your loved ones. And so that's why we built planyourlifespan.org.
Yeah.
It's a website here at Northwestern Medicine that allows people to communicate about what they would want if something happened.
Yes.
You know, if they had a stroke or if they, you know, had Alzheimer's that got worsened. So it allows people to have conversations and it's free to use.
Good. And have there been studies that psychologically people are healthier, mentally healthier when they are in their own homes as opposed to another location?
Yeah, actually, here at Northwestern, we've done some of that research where we've shown that it is better for seniors to age in place. You know, and it's better for their communities, it's better for themselves, it's better for their mood, and even for their thinking. So the more we can do to help our seniors be in their own home, it's important. And with today's opportunities, like here at Northwestern, we've got a house call program. We can deliver medical care in the home. There's so much more that can be done with technology.
Yeah.
So there's so many more opportunities for people to be helped in their own home.
Yeah. And it's considerably less expensive than actual nursing home care, and in many cases, assisted living as well.
Yeah, and it's more about what the senior wants. Because if the senior wants to stay in their home, then there's definitely ways to do it, especially if they're willing to accept help.
Yeah, good. You have people at your various locations there that actually can talk to the patient, we'll call them patient at this point, and discuss this, right?
Yeah, and so being a geriatrician here at Northwestern Medicine, you know, if you haven't seen a geriatrician, you know, it's a great opportunity to have these kind of conversations. Especially if the family comes with a senior and we discuss what's going to happen down the road, or this is kind of where your thinking is and this is what sort of support you'll need. So it's a great kind of objective way of looping in the medical team.
Hey, everybody needs support. I can't even do my taxes by myself, and I and I admit it, you know, and I can't.
Yeah, it's interdependence.
It is. I mean, I have trouble talking to certain people that I don't get along with. I admit that. So, you know, there you go. All right. How do we get more information about this?
Sure. You can go to planyourlifespan.org.
Okay.
Or visit the Northwestern Medicine Geriatrics website, where we're frequently posting our research.
Okay, perfect. Hey, thanks for the information. Kind of makes us all a bit more comfortable realizing that there are more options than we thought there were. It's a comfort thought thing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, Ron.
Hi, Ron.
Hello, everybody. Dr. Anna Pavlik joins us now, and also Gary Larrabee. The doctor is a medical oncologist at NYU, and Gary is a patient and a clinical trial participant. We're talking about skin cancer and a specific type of skin cancer called metastatic melanoma. I'll be honest with you, everybody over the age of 50 is starting to see dermatologists as a regular annual checkup thing, and we're starting to learn that this is an area of the medical world that we should be starting to pay attention to. But I must admit that get confused as to all the different types of quote-unquote skin cancers that are available to us.
Well, there are really three of the most common types of skin cancers. Mm-hmm. One is squamous cell, one is basal cell, one is melanoma. Basal cell is the most common, squamous cell is number two, melanoma is number three. However, melanoma is the most deadly of all the skin cancers because it has the ability to spread to other parts of the body.
Okay.
And can really be very, it's a life-threatening problem.
All right. Gary, you're a patient and you're involved in a clinical trial. Tell me your involvement here.
Yes, well, I was a stage one melanoma patient for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. After 5 years, I was considered, I guess, clean. But soon after that, I developed extreme energy loss, Ron, and turned out that I was now dealing with stage four metastatic melanoma because of this BRAF mutation that we're talking a lot about these days. And I was in very... I didn't know what my prognosis, in fact, was quite grim.
Oh.
But thankfully, my oncologist recommended a drug combination that would attack this BRAF gene like it was attacking my body.
Yes.
And I enrolled in this Columbus trial, and eventually the Columbus trial, the two-drug combination, gained approval by the FDA.
Uh-huh. Oh, good. And it's been effective for you, I would assume.
Yes, sure it has, for a long, long period of time.
That's fantastic. May I ask what part of the body this had become apparent?
Yeah, initially, I had an issue on my shoulder, but my major issue with the BRAF gene occurred in my chest next to my right lung.
I see.
And the drugs have been very, very helpful.
Good. How long have you been involved in this helpful part?
Been involved with this clinical trial for a little more than 5 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's good. Now we're talking about good track record stuff. Okay. Doctor, tell me the importance of visiting a dermatologist. Is there a certain age where one would start doing that, similar to having colonoscopies at a certain age?
Well, there are no overall recommendations for visiting a dermatologist.
Really? Okay.
It really correlates with what a patient's risk factors are.
Uh-huh.
Of fair skin, blonde hair, blue eyes, have a family history of melanoma, have had excessive sun exposure, multiple burning, blistering sunburns as a child.
Yes.
These are things that would encourage me to tell patients, you know, it's a good idea to start seeing a dermatologist sooner rather than later. If a parent was diagnosed with melanoma at early age, then clearly they should get their children seen by a pediatric dermatologist.
Because your original description was all Caucasians, you know. Anyway, pretty much. I mean, I think every, you know, getting sunburn as a child is a rather normal story.
Well, you know, hopefully nowadays most parents are being more educated with respect to sun protection.
Yeah.
Sunscreen, putting their children in sun protective clothing, wearing sunglasses, sun hats.
Yes.
So I think nowadays children are better protected, but not all. And again, there are still people who will go to the beach, lay on the beach, get a tan. But even more frightening, I think, is use of tanning salons.
Oh, my God, yes.
With the intensity of the UV radiation that patients expose themselves to.
Well, that's like smoking cartons of cigarettes. I mean, it's the same risk that you're taking. And if you're not smart enough to figure that out, then you have to be told, I suppose. But I went through an episode myself. Which was startling to me. I was told, you know, it was something that was removable. But at the same time, I said, well, how did I get this? And they said, well, you probably, when you were a child, like 5 years old, 3 years old, you were exposed to the sun too much. And it was like all the way back then, that manifests itself now in my later years. And I said, yeah, that's what happens. I thought, wow, that's shocking.
Yeah, because you got to remember when you're young, your DNA is rapidly dividing because it's growing, and you're exposing growing cells to excessive UV radiation.
Yes.
So the damage that occurs happens when you're younger, but the outcome of that damage presents itself later.
Yeah, very much later. Yes, no question about it. Gary, may I ask your age?
I am 69.
Okay. The symptoms that you had are not unlike a person who is growing older and starts to slow down and starts to get tired as a normal course of physiology. So how did you know the difference?
Well, I just got up one morning and went to work, and all of a sudden, it did hit me like a ton of bricks in the face.
Oh.
And I had no energy, and I couldn't walk up a short flight of stairs.
Oh, okay. So that's extreme.
And it was extreme, and we took it from there, thankfully, and here I am today.
Wow. Okay, doctor, what is the message? What are we throwing out here as a result? I mean, this is not common, but it's not rare either. What should we be doing?
Well, I think clearly prevention is the number one key to making an impact on the diagnosis of melanoma, because it's a very preventable cancer. However, I think the take-home message is also that this is no longer a death sentence. I have been involved in melanoma for a very long period of time and have watched the evolution of these new agents that can actually target these BRAF mutations that have really changed and saved people's lives. So there are excellent therapies out there. So even if you're diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic melanoma, we do have treatment options that will impact someone's overall prognosis.
That's great. But I guess the other bottom line is that if you don't catch it, then you don't catch it. So you've got to. You got to be aware about your health, and you got to get yourself checked out every once in a while.
You got to practice safe sun techniques, be a dermatologist, and just be smart.
Yeah. Well, good information. Where can we go to get more?
Clearly, patients can speak to their physicians regarding melanoma and treatment options. However, if healthcare providers would like more information regarding the trial that Gary participated in, which is the MBUS trial, that information is available at a website. It's www.tovi2.com.
Okay. Patient education is important, because here's a situation where if you went to your doctor, dermatologist, and mentioned this, then you're doing your part. If you fail to mention it or are aware of something like that, then there may be an option that gets passed up. So that's also very important as well. Gary, you're doing well. I'm happy about that. Thank you so much for informing us about this.
Thank you.
Okay. Both of you, please take care. Thank you.
on.
Hi, Susan. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. Susan McKelvey joins us now. She's Communications Manager, the National Fire Protection Association. And we're talking about fire risks during the holiday season. And fire is on our minds because of what's been in the news in California, without question. So it's topical, and here we are. The holiday season ushers in more concerns, doesn't it?
It does. You know, there's a lot of potential fire hazards that are associated with the holiday season. People are doing a lot of decorating in their homes. You know, they're oftentimes using candles and electrical lighting, and of course a lot of people have Christmas trees in their homes. Yeah. And then on top of that, they're doing cooking for friends and family, and cooking is a leading cause of home fires.
Really?
And you know, also in a lot of areas of the country, it is cold out, so everyone's got their heating systems on, and heating is a second leading cause of home fires. So all those factors combined all increase those risks.
No, I'm scared. I mean, it's like everything. And fireplaces, you know, is lighting fires and things, and wow.
But here's the good news, though. Virtually all these fires or these fire hazards can be mitigated by taking really simple steps.
Mm-hmm.
So you can really still enjoy the holiday season safely and still use all these things and do all these things with just a little bit of precaution in mind.
Okay. So what are some of the major things to keep in mind when we're dealing with anything that could potentially cause a fire?
So, you know, with Christmas trees, obviously they are large combustible items that you're bringing into your home. So particularly with fresh trees, you want to make sure that they're well-watered and hydrated. You know, you water them daily. For candles, you want to make sure that you keep a really close eye on them, make sure they're in locations that they can't get knocked over easily, or that, you know, pets or children can't knock them over. And when you're finished using them, you blow them out. You know, when you leave the room, go to sleep. Obviously, if you leave your home, make sure the candles are out. And then just make sure your electrical lighting is in good working order. So if you use holiday lights, make sure they don't have cracked or frayed cords.
Yes.
You know, simple things like that can make all the difference between a safe and a tragic holiday season. So just important to think of those things when you're decorating.
Okay. Is it a falsehood that if you have circuit breakers in your house, then electrical fires pretty much can't happen, that everything would just shut down anyway? Is that true or not true?
Well, I think you have to just take basic, you know, precautions in mind. You want to make sure when you're using electrical lighting that you don't overload outlets.
Yeah.
You just want to always make sure that you're erring on the side of safety. So we encourage people to try to just use one plug per receptacle outlet.
Yeah.
If you're using heating appliances or devices, you want to make sure that you don't overload those outlets as well.
Yeah.
So just using a little bit of common sense, I think, can really go a long way toward using any kind of electrical appliance safely.
Okay. I mean, not to be funny or anything, but there was a time in recent history when people put candles on their trees and you left, you know, you the only source of light was lamp oils and flames, and you would certainly leave your place with the flames still going. It's amazing half the world didn't burn around.
Well, this is true. You know, the good news is that we actually have done a really nice job of educating people about ways to prevent fires, and the numbers bear that out.
Mm-hmm.
The number of home fires has been steadily declining over the years, so that's the good news, but fires still do happen.
Yeah.
So we know we still have more work to do in educating people. Fortunately, I think we've come a long way since putting candles on trees. I think hopefully we've done our job in making sure people know that's not a good idea.
Yeah. What do you do in case a flame does break out and a fire does start and you do witness it? There are so many different types of fires and so many different ways of treating them. I mean, what do you do?
So at NFPA, our priority is everyone's safety. So, you know, there's a fire in your home, first of all, you want to make sure that you have working smoke alarms to alert you to a fire as quickly as possible. And then you want to make sure that everyone in your home knows how to get out as quickly and safely as possible. And if you have a home escape plan that everyone's practiced, that's a great way to ensure that if the smoke alarm sounds, everyone knows how to snap into action and get out quickly.
Yeah. I had a friend that went through that, and the one thing that I learned from them was to have all your documents and things that you need to grab that could burn away have them in one place and ready to be portably taken out of the home?
You know, it's a good idea if there are things that you want to make sure in the event of a fire, that you want to protect them, that they're in. You can get, like, fire-safe boxes.
Yes, there you go.
But, again, for us at NFPA, you know, things can be replaced,
yeah,
but people can't.
But people can't, right.
The goal is to get out as quickly as possible and just stay safe. Once the fire department, you know, call the fire department as quickly as possible, and once they get there, let them do the work they're trained to do. You know, they're equipped to go back in a burning building. We're not.
Yeah, okay. Any other tips that are beyond the obvious of just watch out?
Yeah, just, you know, I think by having added awareness of where potential hazards exist in your home, you can take some simple steps to prevent those fires from happening, and that really can make the difference between a joyous and a tragic season. So, again, just added awareness and some extra time to make sure you reduce the risk of having those types of fires can really ensure a safe holiday.
I know what a lot of people don't do, and that's change the batteries on their smoke detectors if it's battery-driven, or to have a battery backup system. And most houses really don't have fire extinguishers at all.
Well, you're right. You need to make sure that you change batteries as needed. So if you have a smoke alarm that uses a traditional battery, you want to make sure that you test your smoke alarms monthly to make sure that they're working. And if they begin to chirp, you need to replace the batteries. Yeah. And if you still have issues with the alarm, it means that the alarm that it's time for the alarm itself to be replaced.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Good. Fire extinguishers important, or is that something you leave to the professionals?
Yeah, so fire extinguishers can be great tools for putting out small containable fires, but you need to know if you have the right type of extinguisher for the type of fire you're fighting, and you also have to have the right training to use it properly.
That's
so
there's
a lot of things to consider with fire extinguishers. Most people don't have that kind of training or know-how, particularly in a scary situation like a fire.
Yes.
So we are, again, our goal is just to make sure people are safe. So we encourage people really just to get outside, call the fire department in a fire.
Of course, the idea is not to let it happen in the first place.
That's your best bet of all.
Yes, okay. Well, that's important information because it does spike during the holiday season. And certainly what happened in California kind of, when we saw the devastation, I think it gave a lot of people a wake-up call. And, you know, it's not that, you know, it's just, sometimes good things come out of bad things, and that is being aware.
Well, you're right. Unfortunately, sometimes the tragedies that make things make people much more aware that these are real risks, and they have to be prepared in the event of them.
Yes, Susan, thank you so much for the information. It's life saving to many people.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, take care.
You too.
All right, bye bye.
Hello.
Hello.
You're on the line with Becky Baines and David Gruber.
Hi.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Becky Baines joins us. She's been with us many times before. She's vice president and editorial director of National Geographic Kids, which is a series that we follow here on this program. Every time something new comes out, we talk about it. And also David Gruber, who is an expert in exploring. He's a marine biologist, coral reef and photosynthesis expert, and a word I can't even say, and an underwater photographer, and he's with National Geographic now. And my gosh, okay, here we are. So are you both in Washington?
I'm in Washington. This is Becky. Hi.
Yep.
And I believe David's in New York. Are you in New York, David?
Yeah, this is David Gruber. I'm in New York City.
Okay, and I'm in Boston. This is like the Bermuda Triangle, kind of.
Yeah.
All right, okay. National Geographic Kids are just incredible. We're all familiar with National Geographic. Some people may not be familiar that there's a whole series that's geared more toward the kid age. But as I've told you many times before, Becky, there's no distinction for me. I'm they're both the same. I learned just as much from everything. We're talking about, David, with your background, I guess, we talk about space exploration all the time, but we don't as frequently talk about a whole nother frontier that's actually on this planet.
Exactly. I mean, I think about as we explore Mars and as we send these probes out there, I mean, space exploration is completely fascinating. But I always think about, you know, what would it be like if we found something like a sperm whale on another planet? Yeah. Like, we would go absolutely crazy. Yeah. But yet, we have these animals right here, and we barely know about them. So there's just so many mysteries to explore in the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, an explorer is a certain breed of person, because humans are always curious. There's no question about that. But then there's those that actually go out and satisfy our curiosity.
Yeah. Curiosity, I think, is the main thing. And that's really what this book does, is try to, instill that desire to kind of look underneath the rock or even find out what's in your own backyard. And really, with me as a kid, it started out just really exploring my own backyard. And then my backyard just got bigger and bigger and bigger until it, you know, encompassed the whole ocean.
Wow. Becky,
so I do deep sea exploration. I'm sorry.
No, go on.
We use submarines. We use robotics. It's really a kind of fun thing that involves both the physical aspects of diving deep down in the ocean at night, as well as the kind of mental part of thinking about these things deeply and designing little robotic devices that could catch something as delicate as a jellyfish and then let it go.
Well, I was going to say, Becky, as with National Geographic and National Geographic Kids, the pictures are so involving. They just draw you into these areas of the world and of exploration that we could never really see without looking at these publications.
Yeah, so that's David's exactly right. You know, all of our books that we do really serve to explore or to inspire the inner explorer in all of us. Mm-hmm. And this particular series that David's been involved in is called the Explorer Academy. And it's really exciting because it's our first foray into fiction. Yeah. We have a new imprint called Under the Stars, and we're exploring everything kind of in our planet under the stars.
Yeah.
And it's really fun because it kind of taps this new audience for us, which is some kids just shy away from nonfiction, no matter how exciting it is. You know, David can attest to the fact that there's so much cool stuff on our planet that kids don't even really know about.
Yeah.
And so what we've done with this book is we've created kind of this really fun, action-packed adventure stories that include these photorealistic illustrations, and they actually include photographs in the fiction story.
Right.
And we've layered in all this real-world information, including all this exploration information inspired by our own National Geographic explorers. And then when you get to the back of this fiction book, where everything seems so wild and fantastical, we have interviews with our own explorers, like David. He's included in the back of the second book, where he talks about the real-world science he works on and how that actually works into the fiction story. And it's like, wow, like, this stuff is so cool, and it's actually out there, and it's absolutely incredible. It kind of opens kids' eyes up to the real, really cool stuff that exists on our planet.
Yeah. Well, you know, one can be tricked and not know that it's a fictional story, even though, of course, it's that's where it's at. But to me, I didn't know what the line was.
Yeah. The line is definitely blurred. You know, it takes place in the not-too-distant future. We got a recommendation on this first book. It's called The Nebula Secret from J.J. Abrams, who's like the king of, you know, sci-fi.
Yeah.
And there's all these, like, the robotics that David was just talking about. Like, in the story, our protagonist has, like, a little drone that, like, follows him around, and it's the size of a honeybee.
Yeah.
And to kids, they're like, oh, that's so cool. I wish I had, like, a personal drone that, like, shot video and could, you know, spy on things. And but those things exist. And, you know, David's talking about a robot that can dive to the bottom of the ocean and is so gentle that it can, like, you know, hold a jellyfish. Like, that's pretty incredible.
It is. It is. It's definitely blurred. There's no question about it. It's just, I mean, the whole concept is amazing. Of course, the story drags you into it. But I mean, you know, I've always been intrigued with space, but it's always been like not a reachable concept for me. Like, I can't reach out and touch space, as far as that's concerned. But I do dip my toes in the ocean every once in a while So I feel more of a connection to possibilities where my toes are.
I love that. Yeah, there is so much possibility in the ocean, and we've really just begun to explore it. You know, humans have not even had scuba for that long, and not many marine biologists get to go in submarines. So for me, it's like world upon world upon world, like just keeps going deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
And you know, how many cool things we can learn, and that's kind of the ideas we want to get across in this book, is just how much there is left to explore on this planet.
So let's talk about Explorer Academy, Becky. This is a series?
Yes, this is a series. So the first book called Explorer Academy, Your Nebula Secret, came out in September, and the second book is out in March called The Falcon's Feather. But this holiday season, if you have any fiction readers, if you have any kids who are reluctant readers, it's a really thrilling, fast-paced adventure story. It's got secrets and codes hidden throughout. But it's what's really fun for us is that it's based on kind of this fictionalized National Geographic.
Yes.
There's an organization called the Society that's kind of at the world's leading organization for exploration and research. They're on the forefront of all these like major breakthroughs and things like that. But they have a school called the Explore Academy, and every year they invite 24 kids across the globe to come train at the school.
Mm-hmm.
And our hero's name is Cruz. He's 13, and he's from Hawaii. Super smart kid. He gets an invitation to attend the Explore Academy, but we quickly learn that he's a bit of a legacy. His mom was actually one of the top scientists at the Society before she died in a mysterious lab accident when he was a little kid. But, of course, no sooner does he arrive that he discovers there's a little bit more to the story. And it may not have been an accident, after all. And not only that, but she left behind a puzzle that he actually needs to put together the pieces of and solve. And the coolest thing about this school is that it's not like an actual, there's no, like, you know, castle or Hogwarts they go to. It actually takes place on a ship that travels the world. And so they're going on these expeditions with explorers. There's all types of, like, different professors that are inspired by our own explorers. So they're out doing, you know, archaeological digs. They're doing dives. And so you get to learn about what explorers in the field do.
Right.
But the whole time, Cruz is kind of following these clues that his mom left for him and putting together pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And so it's just a really, really fun story.
Is there a companion where we can actually see some of the underwater exploration that takes place for real?
David, do you want to answer about some of the content that you have?
Yeah, I mean, definitely a lot of my work, you know, ends up on National Geographic, and we've got this this site called Luminescent Labs where we post our things.
Yeah.
And right now we have an exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History called Unseen Oceans, where we get across some of the new discoveries we've been finding on how fish see and hidden worlds of getting behind animal eyes. So we now have the technology to kind of like use some of our new inventions to kind of like get behind a shark. I designed a shark eye camera and then swam with sharks so I can see the world from their perspective. So, but yeah, there's probably just National Geographic, American Museum of Natural History are great places.
Becky, when we usually talk, we usually have the big illustrated true stuff that's going on. Is this the first departure for National Geographic kids to where it's an actual book, an actual novel?
So we did a little bit of fiction years ago, but this is our first big deep dive into an actual fiction imprint. So this is the first of a couple fiction series we're doing. And this is what we like to call a 360 property.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to have presence on the web, and also we're doing some stuff in Kids Magazine.
Good.
So there is more content if you check out our website, which is kids.nationalgeographic.com.
Good.
you can find the Explore Academy there. There's all sorts of games and codes that kids can break. There are some videos. We've done some videos with our explorers, so you can learn a little bit more about the real-life explorers mm-hmm. there as well. So it's a great tool to get kids interested in this type of content.
Yeah.
And it just really sparks, you know, a light bulb might go off for some kids about some of the stuff that's really out there. And, of course, we bring National Geographic initiatives, and there's conservation efforts. There's, you know, all sorts of, you know, information about endangered sure. animals, things like that. So, you know, we want kids to be aware of what's going on in the world in a way that's exciting for them and fun.
Mm.
And I think that this series is just kind of really yes. hits the nail on the head.
Yeah, what hit me right away was, you know, National Geographic magazine style, very engaging. But I think it's still important for a child to read. And when they're reading something that they're really into, they read more voraciously. And it's just a good exercise for a developing mind to actually sit down and read a novel. I think this is a very interesting idea and direction every once in a while. What is the target age group?
The target for this is 8 to 12, but of course, you know, we like to think it extends across
yeah.
a couple different age ranges. And,
yeah.
you know, everybody at work is really obsessed with this series,
sure,
so
sure.
I think that adults would like it too.
Okay, yeah, and we'll wait for the motion picture. So,
yes, of course.
Right, of course.
Starring David Gruber.
Well, yeah, yes, and Becky, you're probably in it too. I don't know. Maybe you can take a role there.
I'd like to pitch myself.
Okay. All right, one more time, the some general websites that we can do. The book is Explore Academy, The Nebula Secret. That's available everywhere, mm-hmm. I would assume. And how do we hook up with the whole National Geographic experience?
So our website is kids.nationalgeographic.com, and when you get there, you'll find a tab to click on the Explore Academy, and I'll let David give you his website
yes.
information one more time as well.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, they just did a really great video called Marine Biologist's Best Job Ever, which on Nat Geo Kids, which profiles some of my works, and I put my stuff on a site called Luminescent Labs, really just an Instagram account.
Beautiful. The Nebula Secret, National Geographic Kids, Explorer Academy. Thank you so much to the both of you. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for having
us on.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Full of information, huh? I hope it was of some interest or value to you. I'm sure it was somewhere along the line. Hey, we'll be back next time with a brand new show. This was extra. Again, no charge. Usually it's $10,000 per episode, but this was no charge. Have yourselves a wonderful day. I wish you peace. Knowledge is everything.